Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, your no-hype resource for all things crypto. I'm your host, Laura Shin. If you've been enjoying Unchained, pop into iTunes to give us a top rating or review. That helps other listeners find the show.
WeTrust is a new fundraising platform that allows you to donate crypto to nonprofits. WeTrust will match your donation through Giving Tuesday on November 27th. Go to WeTrust.io/unchained to make your donation.
The future of lending is here. AltLending enables companies to leverage their Bitcoin or Ethereum assets to borrow US dollars. To learn more, go to altlending.com and use promo code UNCHAINED for offer details for an interest-free month. Crypto collateralized. AltLending.com.
Abra is the easiest way to invest in crypto. Their all-in-one exchange and wallet provides access to 28 cryptocurrencies and Bit10, the only crypto index product available to everyone, everywhere. Get started with $25 in Bitcoin at abra.com/unchained.
The topic for today's show is a new trend that some people are calling generalized mining, others calling it mining 2.0. Here to discuss are Jake Bruckman, founder, CEO, and managing director of CoinFund, and Tushar Jain, managing partner of Multicoin Capital. Welcome, Jake and Tushar.
Hi, Laura. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Jake. Really excited to talk about this with you guys today. This is going to be a fun conversation. Thanks for having me on, Laura. Big fan of the podcast.
Jake, since you haven't been on the show before, let's start with you. What's your background and what does CoinFund do?
Sure. My background is in mathematics and computer science. Spent about 5 years in the hedge fund world in New York. On the financial technology side, I was then a technical product manager and engineer at Amazon for about 2 years working on ad tech products, and then CTO of a fintech startup called Triton Research, where we did a lot of very interesting financial analysis on private technology companies. I learned about Bitcoin in 2011 and have been sort of in the space ever since. And when I saw, you know, the Ethereum white paper, that really made a lot of sense to me. And CoinFund was formed around the concept of building portfolios to diversify digital assets. So CoinFund launched in July of 2015 as one of the first crypto asset-focused funds in the U.S.
And Tushar, although you were previously on the show with your partner, Kyle Samani, why don't you briefly tell us how you got into crypto and what Multicoin does?
Absolutely. So Multicoin is a thesis-driven crypto fund. I got into crypto actually through a similar story to Jake, where Ethereum was really what drew me in to the crypto world. I had seen Bitcoin before, and Bitcoin was interesting to me, but the scope of Bitcoin was just so limited, and Ethereum to me was a much more ambitious vision, and I saw new ways to coordinate human economic activity that weren't possible before. And I knew that I had to be in this space once I fully understood the implications of what this technology could enable. So back in early 2017, my partner Kyle and I decided to launch Multicoin Capital, and we went live last year.
A slew of crypto hedge funds launched in 2017, but I know several of them are now just calling themselves crypto funds since they don't really act like traditional hedge funds. Jake, I noticed you've been using that phrase crypto fund as well. Why? Like, what's the job of being a partner at a crypto fund really like, and how does that differ from managing a traditional hedge fund?
Yeah, well, thanks, Laura. I mean, I think that running a crypto fund is actually quite a bit different than, you know, running a hedge fund or running a VC fund. I think crypto funds, you know, tend to be sort of structured in the vocation that one participates in when working at a crypto fund has to be tailored to the asset class. And you have a really interesting asset class here. You have an asset class of digital assets, first and foremost, Their liquidity profiles are quite different than what you would see in you know, venture capital, private equity kind of markets. And more than anything else, the technology, you know, around digital assets and things like Ethereum and Bitcoin and decentralized networks in general is pretty advanced and requires some, you know, probably pretty deep knowledge. So the approach that we have, you know, taken at CoinFund is that we're a pretty multidisciplinary team. We bring together computer science, math, as well as financial experience and experience on Wall Street and investing to try to make sense of the space. And then when the fund manages assets, I think it's a bit of a hybrid between, you know, typically what people do in venture capital, where they evaluate early stage teams and kind of make long-term bets on the products that they're building. And then, you know, also managing a portfolio of highly liquid assets that trade on 24-hour markets. So I think, you know, crypto funds kind of combine those two disciplines and really require a lot of different skills to make sense of the space.
And Tushar, how would you compare and contrast them?
Yeah, I think Jake's completely right here. Crypto fund has caught on as a term because I think this is a new type of asset management firm. We are combining venture capital type diligence and venture capital type effort and work. You know, we're working with the teams to help make them successful, which is more akin to a VC firm than a traditional hedge fund. However, we do operate in public markets, and we need to be able to leverage liquidity in order to earn the best returns possible. So we are also somewhat like a hedge fund in that regard. And then there are other aspects of what we do, which are something brand new, which are very crypto native, which I think is what we're going to talk about today, around how we can help the portfolio teams in this very blockchain native or crypto native way with these different tactics. And I think all of those combined together is what makes us a crypto fund and not just a VC fund or not just a hedge fund.
Yeah, that is the perfect segue to talking about generalized mining. Why don't you guys describe for me all the ways in which crypto funds can support decentralized projects and then explain what generalized mining is and how that fits in this larger universe?
You know, just stepping back for a second and just thinking about this concept of what does generalized mining mean, let me just say the following. So I think over time, what we're seeing is more and more decentralized networks being built in the world, right? So around 2015, the decentralized networks that we were very familiar with were cryptocurrency networks like Bitcoin, maybe asset issuance networks like Counterparty or NXT or BitShares. And then Ethereum came along and created a decentralized network, which enabled Turing complete smart contracts and kind of subsumed, you know, the previous two. The world that we live in 2018 is a little bit more advanced, right? So we see a proliferation of decentralized networks, and it feels like they're poised to proliferate further. And the applications of those networks are actually quite diverse, right? So today we not only see smart contract platforms and cryptocurrencies, we also see decentralized networks for storage, for computation. We see social media networks implemented as decentralized networks, such as in the case of Steemit. We see different decentralized networks for various kinds of computational services like LivePeer, which does video transcoding. We see financial services like lending protocols and exchange protocols. And the picture that begins to emerge is that, you know, in this world of very decentralized networks that have very specific applications and very specific domains, it turns out they're not companies. They don't, you know, typically have a management team. These are public networks. And yet they need, you know, a variety of supply side kind of services to function, right? So in Bitcoin, those services are provided by miners, and the service that they're providing is transaction validation, right? Same in Ethereum. When you go over to a social media network like Steemit, you have people creating content, and then you have other people or even bots curating that content. When you're in a storage network, you have people providing storage, and that could be from their laptop. It could be from a data center. When you're in some kind of decentralized finance network, like a lending network, then you need parties to come into that network and provide capital, and so on and so forth. And so the number of roles in decentralized networks seems to be growing over time. You know, we used to have miners and users, but then in proof of stake, we have validators and users, and now a new kind of role called a delegator, which could be a user, but could be a speculator or investor, or just someone interested in securing the network. You know, when you go to a network like LivePeer, out of the gate, you have five roles, you know, and that includes kind of miners, it includes transcoders, it might include software nodes that are orchestrators for the hardware nodes to support the scalability of that network, and so on and so forth. And so when we get to this concept of generalized mining, the way that I think about it is there is a world of opportunities there in decentralized networks that would allow third parties to come in and provide these kinds of vital, you know, supply side services in exchange for compensation that's allocated by the network. And those are financial opportunities. They're opportunities to make a return. I think they're slightly different return opportunities than if you were just investing in a blockchain startup or some kind of decentralized network token, because they have different economics. And this space of generalized mining opportunities is also, you know, it's very diverse, and different kind of players in the space fit better into different areas of, you know, of that set of opportunities.
Yeah, and to just dive a little bit deeper there, the way that I like to explain this generalized mining role is that we are investors in these crypto networks. These are early stage projects. And by being participants in these networks, either on the supply or the demand side, and occasionally acting in ways that may not seem economically rational for in a vacuum, but are economically rational if you consider the entirety of the portfolio, we are able to help increase the chances that our portfolio companies' network effects actually catch on, right? So Jake talks a bit about LivePeer, and I think LivePeer is a fantastic example, right? With LivePeer as a decentralized video transcoding network, it has a classic chicken or egg problem. And if we as investors can bring the chicken, then that can help solve the chicken or egg problem. And that's what I think, at least for Multicoin, is the intention behind generalized mining or this evolving role of crypto investors, is to use not only our capital, but our technical know-how and our other resources in order to accelerate the network effects of these projects that we're invested in.
So I agree with Tushar, and it's in the context of this world, it's really interesting to think about, you know, what is the role of specifically funds kind of within the set of these opportunities. So one thing that becomes, you know, really apparent is that a lot of staking networks today are coming out onto the market, and they create an opportunity to help secure the network in exchange for sort of a return stream, right? And as a fund, you know, if you're holding digital assets and there is an opportunity to kind of make a return that's there, it's a very compelling opportunity for funds. And it also comes with some competitive pressure, right? So if like some fund adopts that strategy as a, you know, competitive way of making returns, that might create some pressure on other funds to do the same. And there's probably a lot of other reasons why, you know, a fund might want to participate here. You know, if you're a good crypto fund, you should be invested, as Tushar alludes to, in the long-term success of your portfolio companies. And if there's a way that you as an investor can add value to the network that your portfolio company is building, then that seems to be a compelling reason to engage that network. And I'll give you a quick example. You know, if you look at layer two networks, layer two payment networks kind of work on hubs today, right? And the capitalization of a hub also determines the throughput of that network. And so the more hubs you have, the more capital is locked up in those hubs providing throughput, kind of the more successful your network is poised to be, because you're helping to build the network effects of those payments, right? And if you as a fund who's invested in one of these projects can add that value, that becomes incredibly valuable for, you know, and measurable for the portfolio company.
Yeah, I think something that interests me is earlier you were also mentioning that some of the other ways you guys can invest in these projects are through equity or investing in the tokens directly. So how do you compare with this kind of service with those types of support?
So, Laura, that's a really interesting question. It's something that we think a lot about, both from the investor perspective, in terms of, you know, where should we allocate capital, and also from the perspective of how can we best support our investments. We believe that most of the value that's created using this technology will be captured in tokens, not in the equity of corporations. There is a significant opportunity for these companies to emerge that build services on top of this technology. However, given how the value capture works and where the customer relationship really is, and you know, we're talking a little bit about aggregation theory here, we expect that almost all of the value ends up being captured in the protocol itself, or the token of the protocol itself. So this actually presents another opportunity for good crypto investors, because in order to help increase the chances of the protocol being successful, it can be a good decision to actually invest in a company that's building on that protocol, even if, all things considered, the protocol token itself presents a better risk-adjusted return than the equity of that company. And it would, in many cases, do so, because if the company is successful, it just drives most of the value back right into the protocol. But once again, we have a chicken or egg type problem. The protocol can only be successful if many companies build on top of it. And so it can be worth it to fund those companies, kind of like a VC would save capital for a follow-on investment in future rounds. I think, you know, it makes sense for crypto investors to reserve capital in the same way, to invest in companies or other projects within that ecosystem that help support their initial investment.
Yeah, I just realized that actually what this is it's investing in tokens and then putting work into the network. And it sort of tracks, I guess, traditional VC where, well, depending on which firm you're talking about, they would invest and then do a lot of work to help that startup. But here it's more measurable and it's like actually, and it's more technical. Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah, I think so.
I would say so.
Yeah. And actually, just a quick question I wanted to know, how did you come up with this term generalized mining? I think some others call it mining 2.0. Are there any other terms?
Yeah, there's a bunch of people kind of discussing this idea. I think, you know, in the forefront of most people's minds today are staking networks like Cosmos and Tezos. And so a lot of companies tend to think of this vocation as, oh, we're going to stake tokens and we're going to make a return. To me, it's a little bit of a, you know, the opportunity set is a little bit more broad than that, right? So you have some opportunities that are very hardware intensive, right? This is like classical mining. This is providing storage. This is providing computation or building out data centers for various computational services. These opportunities are very hardware intensive, and you know, they need that economy of scale and they need that large capital. I think in the middle of the opportunity space is a lot of these staking opportunities, right? And this is where a new network comes up. The team provides some software that third parties can run, such as node software. And then that node comprises the network, right? In exchange and compensating those third parties with digital assets from the network. And I think on the other side of the spectrum, you have things that are, you know, a little bit more interesting in the sense that they are a little bit more proprietary. So these are things like market making algorithms, trading algorithms. These are things like maybe creating a machine learning algorithm to curate content on a social media network like Steemit and then performing better than others because your algorithm happens to be more advanced or something like that. Or if you think about the kind of services that are required by, you know, MakerDAO when they liquidate CDPs, right? They need third parties to sort of make a, you know, an arbitrage decision about whether it would make sense to bid for a CDP and get it liquidated and then make a little bit of a return on that.
And so what you're telling me is it sounds like generalized mining does not, it's not limited to only proof of stake systems. You can have this with a proof of work system or any type of consensus algorithm. And it includes not only hardware plays, but also software. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You know, people have called this also supply side services or network service provision. And generally, you know, I define this space as kind of any supply side service provided by a third party to a decentralized network in exchange for kind of compensation, usually but not always in digital assets allocated, you know, by the network to that third party. So this is, you know, most of the time a sort of on protocol activity. It's available globally because these networks are globally available in public. You know, and they present a variety of different return opportunities.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So then, because one question I was going to ask you is whether the goal was to accumulate more tokens or earn a return or simply grow the value of each token, but it sounds like it's kind of all three.
Well, I think, you know, if you take a look at, let's take staking as an example, right? If you take a look at most staking opportunities today, this is an opportunity to take some tokens to, you know, usually lock them up in some way in a decentralized network. There may be risks associated with that. You know, there's technology risk, there's obsolescence risk. And of course, there's also sometimes risks on the protocol itself in terms of slashing. But in return, what you get is a rate of return on your tokens in a token denominated way, right? So you might make 5% a year in tokens. You might make about 20% a year. I think most of the opportunities there, you know, tend to fall into that range. And, you know, and then you ask yourself as an investor, well, am I relying on the kind of token denominated return to say whether this was this a good opportunity, or am I really looking at the fiat denominated return of my tokens, right? And I think today, you know, the fiat denominated volatility of tokens is much, much higher than the 5 to 20% token denominated return of these opportunities. And so when someone goes into a staking opportunity, I think today what they're saying is that we're still betting on the success and growth of this network. This is still an investment decision for me, but by participating in this staking opportunity, I'm actually increasing and maximizing my exposure to this investment opportunity that I have decided upon.
So then with the returns from generalized mining, how do you think they would compare to either traditional VC or just passively investing in tokens?
Yeah, well, I think, again, so the staking opportunities, you know, they have a certain profile where they have a certain rate of return and maybe a certain set of risks. If you go over into kind of other opportunities, and one that comes to mind is, you know, the LivePeer Merkle mine, for example. The LivePeer Merkle mine was essentially a decentralized airdrop where, you know, software miners were incentivized to redeem an airdrop LPT, which is LivePeer tokens, to 2.6 million Ethereum addresses. And when participating in that kind of opportunity, what you're doing as a miner is that you're helping the LivePeer network in a very early stage of its life cycle. You're basically helping the distribution of the token. And in doing so, you're earning LPT. And so you're taking a position in a token that really, isn't quite out on the market today. There's very few venues where it trades today, and there's very little liquidity. And that's fine because this is an early stage of the network. But the return opportunity there, you know, is similar to what you would get if you were an early stage investor in LivePeer, right? Like in the sense that if the token goes 10x, then you have acquired ownership of the token, you know, in a similar way to those early investors. But instead of participating in the round, you have used technology to gain network ownership.
Interesting. So, oh, yeah, Tushar.
I think these examples really help illustrate some of the generalized mining opportunities, but I think this can be expanded beyond that to not only include these opportunities where there are in protocol rewards. And so, you know, something like the LivePeer Merkle mine, that was economically rational in a vacuum. Like it was reasonable for someone to go and participate in that process, regardless of what their opinion of LivePeer was, or if they were trying to, you know, help support the network. I really think of another example to illustrate like where investors can use this generalized mining tactic as part of a broader strategy of supporting their investments. And an easy one is thinking of something like Filecoin, where Filecoin, once again, has a chicken or egg problem upon launch. And there are some in-protocol ways to reward suppliers of bandwidth or suppliers of storage on the network, even if that storage isn't being used. But it can be very economically rational for an investor who owns a large amount of Filecoin to go and bring a lot of storage to the network in the early days, even when there isn't enough demand for it to be utilized, even if provisioning that storage to the network at that point in time costs the investor money. Because if they can then help increase the chances that a new customer will come on to LivePeer and really kickstart those network effects, I think it's worth it, even if it's not economically rational. And so I do think it's worth differentiating between those two categories of generalized mining. One where, you know, there is an in-protocol incentive, and like if you're not doing it, you're leaving money on the table. If you're not staking your Tezos, you are literally leaving money on the table that is yours by rights. However, something like this Filecoin example isn't something where you're leaving money on the table. It's where you're going above and beyond to help your investment.
Yeah, and Tushar, you know, published a great post on this, you know, using that kind of loss leading example. And I think the other example you guys had, Tushar, was like Maker CDPs, right? So we could talk a little bit about that, maybe to introduce the concept. You know, Maker CDPs, or I should say DAI, doesn't have any particular reason why, you know, third parties issue it, right? So if there's a lot of demand for DAI stablecoin, for whatever reason, there's kind of like no immediate economic reason for people to lock up collateral at risk in a CDP in order to issue DAI. But in the same way that, you know, as Tushar points out, like, you know, a fund can kind of loss lead and participate in a network at an initial loss, sort of looking at the long-term view, you know, in that same way, like funds can go in and, for example, create more DAI supply to support that demand. Is that a correct assessment of that, Tushar?
Absolutely. I actually think the Maker example is absolutely perfect because of exactly the dynamics that you described. And an investor in the Maker system has a huge incentive to go and actually create more DAI. So they would have to lock up Ether. They have to pay the interest rate to create DAI. So they're going out of pocket to create the stablecoin that they don't actually need in that scenario. But if they then release that stablecoin onto the market, now there's more DAI available. And that makes it more likely that exchanges will offer trading pairs against DAI. I mean, right now, DAI has something like 60 million in market cap, and Tether has something like 2 billion. It's going to be really difficult for any exchanges to support meaningful trading pairs against DAI if there's only $60 million worth of DAI out there. There's just not enough. And so for investors in Maker who want to increase the probability that DAI becomes the, you know, collateralized, decentralized stablecoin of choice, it makes sense to go lock up $100 million in Ether or $200 million in Ether and go create more DAI. Especially as multi-collateral DAI comes out and you can lock up, you know, different types of assets to create more DAI.
We're going to discuss when it makes sense for funds to offer generalized mining services and more. But first, I'd like to take a quick break for our fabulous sponsors.
Unchained listeners can receive $25 in Bitcoin just for getting started with Abra at abra.com/unchained. Abra's all-in-one exchange and wallet lets everyone, everywhere, easily and securely invest in crypto, with 28 cryptocurrencies available and the Bit10, the first easily accessible crypto index. With as little as $5 a month in Bit10, you can invest in an index of the top 10 cryptocurrencies, professionally rebalanced every month. Get started with $25 in Bitcoin at abra.com/unchained.
A startup that completed an ICO and looking to leverage Ethereum for working capital. A miner looking to buy more rigs without having to sell Bitcoin. Alt lending can help. Alt lending enables companies to leverage their Bitcoin or Ethereum to borrow US dollars while retaining ownership of their crypto assets. We bring years of financial and technological expertise to the blockchain space. Access to institutional capital means borrowers don't have to wait weeks to receive a loan. Our simple and efficient vetting process makes getting a loan easy. No membership tokens or complicated signups required. To learn more, go to altlending.com and use promo code UNCHAINED for offer details for an interest-free month. Asset lending. Reimagined. altlending.com.
WeTrust helps you make the world a better place. WeTrust is a new fundraising platform that allows you to donate crypto to nonprofits that are changing the world for the greater good. WeTrust connects you to organizations you care about most so you can support their work. To inspire you to give, WeTrust will match your donation through Giving Tuesday on November 27th. Go to WeTrust.io/unchained to make your donation. If you want your crypto donations to go farther, go to WeTrust.io/unchained and donate through November 27th.
I'm speaking with Jake Bruckman of CoinFund and Tushar Jain of Multicoin Capital. So the example that you guys have been giving for the advantages that generalized mining provides tend to be around when projects are in their early stages. So is that the only time that it makes sense when you want to get a portfolio project off the ground? Or would you continue to offer generalized mining services even for mature projects?
So I think this is mostly helpful for early stage projects. The thing with mining is that it's supposed to be a relatively permissionless activity, if not completely permissionless, in that anyone can do it. And that's true of actual mining, like, you know, Bitcoin versus these generalized mining tactics that we're talking about, whether, you know, that's supplying on Filecoin or creating DAI, et cetera. Anyone should be able to do them. And so what that means is over time, as competitors enter, you know, because there is literally no barrier to entry, there should be no additional margins on that for the economically rational generalized mining, the ones where you are, actually earning a profit. The investments into protocols that are followed by supporting the protocol, that can exist longer into the protocol's lifecycle. But if at the medium stage or late stage maturity of the protocol, it's still reliant on investors, goodwill to support the protocol and make sure that, there is enough supply or demand on the network, then the protocol has failed and the economics didn't work out. And so it doesn't make sense in that case either. So I think in both the case where this generalized mining is driven by profit within that specific tactic, or if generalized mining is driven by profit across the portfolio. It really is only reasonable to do in the early days and maybe like the middle days at the longest.
I agree with Tushar. I think, you know, most of the opportunities that we see today in generalized mining are kind of opportunities in early stages of networks. And that's partially because, you know, most decentralized networks are in very early stages today. You know, I think like as time goes on, I think we'll see a lot more networks. I think we'll see sort of less volatility kind of in the fiat denominated sense of these tokens. I think we're going to see a lot of opportunities like within decentralized finance to actually create portfolios and positions in these things that are, you know, less volatile. I'll give you a quick example, right? If you're a staking company and you want to maybe build an initial stake of tokens to get into a network, like LivePeer might be an example. They have 15 validators. You need to cross a certain threshold of LPT ownership in order to become an active validator on the network today. Well, what you might do is you might go to a decentralized lending protocol that lends out LPT, and you might borrow that, you know, borrow LPT from that protocol, use that to make a token denominated return, and then return the borrowed LPT. And so what you've just done is you have created kind of a way to, you know, to neutralize your exposure to LPT and just sort of get that token denominated return. There are other strategies, for example, periodic liquidation of those returns that further lowers the fiat denominated volatility. And that might be, you know, that might be an uncorrelated kind of source of returns for your fund. You know, in the long term, I really see people, you know, maybe building out different kinds of portfolios of these opportunities. And I think they also have different risk profiles, right? If you're doing hardware mining, for example, like Bitcoin, you're putting out a lot of capital and it's like relatively safe, you know, within the space of opportunities. And you're making a kind of a smaller return. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you might be not putting in so much capital. You might be putting in some software into a network and you're betting on the success of that network, but the return could look more like a, you know, VC style return or something like that. And the combination of those things into a portfolio, I think kind of creates a differentiator for funds, you know, especially as you look at a lot of funds going long-term long on many of these opportunities or just signing equity deals or just signing SAFTs, you know, and so it's an interesting sort of direction to explore in terms of making crypto portfolios more diversified and safe.
One other thing I wanted to ask about was, Jake, your co-founder, Alexander Vulcan, proposed something called an initial witness offering. And when I read about it, it seemed to me that it kind of worked in conjunction with generalized mining. Would you agree? And if so, describe how it works and how that connects with generalized mining.
I'm not an expert on on the witness offering. There is a post by Alex there, which you guys can read. But I think like the motivation there is essentially trying to understand how, you know, a decentralized network can be sort of brought up and put into production using decentralized tools and in a way that, you know, that tends to be, I guess, like more compatible with the regulatory environment that we have. And I think part of it is, you know, we've seen echoes of this throughout blockchain, right? So you've seen, you know, fully mined assets, for example, like Bitcoin or Steam. Not a lot of people know that actually. Steam never had an ICO. Like Steam tokens have always been mined directly from the network. And the witness offering, you know, kind of takes a similar approach to, you know, bringing up the life cycle of these networks and getting them out. And the way that it's a, you know, the way that it, I think it touches generalized mining is like a network that takes on the strategy, creates, again, opportunities for third parties to come in to mine or to validate transactions and thus help to issue the asset.
Yeah. So one thing that I'm curious about is, does this kind of take this vision of peer-to-peer crypto networks and mean that it's just going to be more professionalized, where it'll be more challenging for everyday people to contribute to these networks?
I mean, I think it's actually quite the opposite, right? Like the way the technology is heading, it's you know, you see, you know, better and better tools that enable kind of normal people to interact with networks. Like you see Web3 enabled browsers. That's one thing. You see a blockchain sort of networks that can use, you know, different kinds of technologies like ZK Starks, for example, you know, to make the blockchain so small, it can fit on your phone. And that actually democratizes the ability of, you know, normal people to just have a node that's running with them at all times, and creates a much more decentralized network than what you see in, you know, in Bitcoin, where kind of a handful of miners control the entire network. And also hardware wallets, I think, you know, still in early stages here, but I kind of like looking forward a couple of years, you know, you can imagine waving your iPhone in front of some kind of decentralized application and being able to, you know, make a payment. And so it becomes even easier than it is today with hardware wallets to interact with them. So overall, I think the trend is actually to put blockchains in the hands of more people, I would say.
Tushar, what do you think? And I wanted to ask, actually, just to add one thing for context, I guess another reason I asked this is because your former research analyst, Miles Snyder, left Multicoin to launch an EOS block producer called Aurora EOS. So yeah, I just want to get a sense of like how much of this is more professionalization versus like actually furthering the decentralized model.
I think it's both. I think it's more professional. And I think I might disagree here slightly with Jake that I don't think that everyday people should be running a node. It just like doesn't add much value, and like everyone having their own full node sounds more decentralized, but it's not, because they're just trusting the developers of the software, right? The centralization point just moves along that value stack somewhere else. And so I think that having more professionalization actually leads to more decentralization, because you have professionals who are qualified to be engaged in the network, who can actually add real value to the network because they are working on the network all day, every day. I think the key for decentralization here is that those professionals are independent and are not all working for the same company or the same, you know, handful of companies, that they are, you know, distributed around the world and are independently making their own decisions, et cetera. But I think having professionals and incentivizing professionals to add value to your network is the right path. Trying to win over the average layperson into adding value to, you know, your decentralized video transcoding network or your layer 2 plasma chain solution is unlikely to me. I just think you're going to have a lot of difficulty convincing them, educating them, and motivating them to do so. However, those opportunities can be extremely attractive for small professional organizations where, you know, you can start up something with 1, 2, maybe 3 people and be a generalized miner on a variety of these various networks and earn a decent return doing so. But that's not necessarily amateur or regular consumer adoption. That's really, you know, small professional team adoption.
And we did talk about how early, you know, this means that you guys will, or anybody who's participating in generalized mining will have kind of more of an influence on the network simply because it is small. So over time, how would you phase that out to make the network more decentralized?
So I think that's a really interesting question. You know, how do you phase out the influence of the early team and the early investors who own a large amount of the protocol? I think there are going to be a number of experiments done on this, and we're going to see the results. I can speculate. I have some ideas on how this might play out, but I don't think you know, this is proven yet. We haven't seen many examples of projects go from, you know, the centralized launch to a decentralized governance or ownership of the project, which, by the way, as an aside, I think is a good thing. I think in the early days, you want to be centralized for agility. Otherwise, you will be outcompeted by someone who, by a protocol that is a little more centralized, that does then further decentralize. I think some of the tactics that can be used to further decentralize a network are perhaps agreements by early investors or founders to actually sell some amount of their stake at some point. It's not just a lockup, but also something like the opposite of a lockup, saying, if you're an early investor in this project, not only, will you hold for at least the first, 1 or 2 years, those are kind of normal lockups that we see, but also since you bought 5% of the total network, you are a larger early stage investor, you also promise that after 5 years, you will start liquidating your stake according to some, schedule. And that way you can help decrease the ownership centralization of the network as it gets to the maturity stages. You can also have commitments from the team ahead of time saying, we are going to work on this in this very centralized, agile manner for the first X months or X years. But after that, we are going to transition governance over to this foundation that will hire, other developers or fund other developers and other small teams in order to further the protocol. And so through those types of mechanisms, I think you will see the outsized influence of early insiders diminish as projects get more mature, because it's just necessary. It'll be a good long-term selfish decision by those investors or by those founders to include these types of clauses that tie their hands, because this then gives users of the network the confidence that there is a clear path towards decentralization.
Something else I was wondering about was, so for so long, everybody was following the so-called FAT protocols thesis, where the theory was that value in this decentralized world would accrue at the protocol layer as opposed to the app layer. And then recently, I feel like, because everything is theoretical, obviously, as time goes on, the thinking around these things shifts. And one good example of that is that USV, which had initially published the FAT protocols thesis, they also recently published a new blog post about how it's not only infrastructure that needs to be built at first, and that the development of these things goes between infrastructure and apps, because the FAT protocols thesis led everybody to be like, I only want to invest in infrastructure. So I'm just curious, how does now this theory about generalized mining, how does that fit in with the evolution of thinking about investing in decentralized networks?
Yeah. So I actually wrote a post, Laura, last year called FAT protocols are not an investment thesis, where I tried to challenge a little bit this idea that you can use a blanket heuristic to see how value accrues in decentralized networks and tokens, right? And, I think by and large, it was an important post to sort of get people thinking along the lines of like, well, how does value actually accrue, and where does it accrue, and what is the mechanism by which it accrues? But I think because the design space of digital assets and the networks around them is so vast, ultimately you need to examine opportunities case by case. And, in my post, I kind of go through a couple of examples where, here value may not accrue in the protocol token, or not completely be reflected in the value of the protocol token. And there's a lot of counterexamples that you can draw sort of on an individualized basis to demonstrate that it's not really, quite so simple. And so kind of based on those ideas, right, like you might think, yes, if I have a protocol that gets big, that, and I own the token and the token accrues the value of that protocol, that might be a good investment. But then you also have to consider the fact that, this is not the times of TCP/IP where you essentially had TCP/IP and one other competitor. This is like hundreds of competing protocols who are vying for the same or overlapping markets, right? And so the investment profile for protocol investing is actually kind of similar to sort of startup investing. There's certainly, very interesting opportunities in middleware, right? When I say middleware, I mean kind of digital assets that are poised to be network agnostic. And where we've seen the most of this, so far, I would say, is probably stable coins. And you see a number of stable coins launching on Ethereum, but also simultaneously launching their protocols on other networks like EOS, for example. And finally, you know, I think a number of VCs and investors in the space kind of over the last year have also come around to the idea that we wrote about of investing in dApps. You know, a lot of people had said, well, you know, it's we got to build the lower layers of the stack first and invest in dApps later. But it's also interesting to consider, you know, companies like Kick or YouNow, who are kind of traditional companies with amazing teams, with a lot of experience shipping software and hundreds of millions of users, right? And taking on some kind of blockchain strategy with a token and trying to accrue value in that token with an audience of people that, you know, they've already kind of converted into their products. And I think that that's an interesting opportunity that a lot of investors have come around to. And finally, there's also opportunities like outside of the decentralization stack that I think are really important to the space. And these are, you know, fundraising platforms and banking services and secondary market platforms that help get investment capital into the decentralization stack, that help to, you know, enable teams to operate and create great products. Whereas it's generally been pretty hard for teams who are, you know, fundraising in cryptocurrency, for example, to get bank accounts and things like that. Generalized mining, I think, forces the person or the group that's evaluating that opportunity to understand how value accrual works. And it's sort of motivating them to be a lot more specific than just kind of this fat protocol heuristic. And I think that's a good thing. And in many ways, it will, I think it will actually support the idea that that value accrues oftentimes in these sort of like lower level, you know, lower level assets, but not always. So that's sort of my take on it.
And I know you also have some interesting views on how this trend fits in with the shift toward scaling via layer two and state channels. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's going to be a while before we see, you know, a lot of layer two technologies out of production and actually supporting real world apps. There's just a few examples of that today. You know, one example is Funfair. Another example is SpankChain that actually have layer two products in production. Things like non-custodial hubs and payment channels. We're sort of still waiting for generalized state channel frameworks and things like that. But I do think that we'll have some examples of that in the coming 6 to 12 months. But as it relates to value accrual, you know, it's interesting to think about. For example, you know, if you take a look, if you compare Lightning Network above Bitcoin and maybe a generalized state channel network above Ethereum, right? So in Bitcoin, you're going to be locking up some collateral on layer one so that you can transact in layer two. And sort of the amount that you can transact is directly proportional to the amount that you lock up, and you're actually taking out, you know, units out of circulation. And it's interesting, like, how does that dynamic impact kind of the Bitcoin layer underneath? Well, it seems like, you know, you lower the circulating supply, so that's good for price. But at the same time, you're collapsing a lot of transactions that maybe would have been on chain into just two, right? Into the transaction that opens the channel, the payment channel, and the transaction that closes it. So does that result in, you know, a decrease in transactions in that network? Or does the growth achieved by, you know, having a layer two payment system above Bitcoin actually outpaces that? You know, it's an interesting question. Now, when you go on to, you know, kind of state, generalized state channel networks on Ethereum, then you realize that, you know, because you're actually instantiating smart contracts in these state channels off the main chain, you're probably implementing some kind of business model using those contracts, right? So if you're like playing chess games for money and the, you know, the provider is taking a fee or something like that, it turns out you're taking away all of those transactions from the layer one, and you're potentially, you know, not sharing the same amount of value that accrues in these off-chain applications with the base layer. And the question really becomes on a case-by-case basis is like, how does this impact, let's say, the price of Ether underneath, if that makes sense?
And so generalized mining sort of solves a certain problem in the sense that you can still accrue value from the scaling of the network, even if that value isn't necessarily accruing at layer one?
Well, I think in the case of layer two specifically, right, if you sort of look at the landscape of what's happening, let's say in state channel networks today, you have on the order of, 15, 20 projects that are working on this stuff. Maybe like half or most of them are open source. So you're not really getting a lot of equity opportunities to invest in those teams. There are some. Out of those, 15, 16 projects, only three of them have tokens. So if you're taking a really, sort of VC lens when you're approaching investment, you're not going to find a lot of equity there. And you're probably not going to find a lot of tokens in those networks. And so if a layer two network takes off and is really valuable, but that network doesn't have a token, the question is, how do you get the exposure to that growth? And sort of I think the best answer to that in today's environment is, well, it makes sense to run, some kind of node on this, some kind of infrastructure on this network, right? So if you're running a hub directly on the network, then you can capture that growth by providing network effect, providing the ability of many different people to transact through your hub. And so, of course, you're taking a, transaction fee on that, and you're making money. But if you're sort of equity focused or token focused, I think you'll find it a lot harder to get that direct exposure to that growth. And plus, you'll have to contend with the fact that there's actually many competing payment networks in that layer. Now, a lot of founders who are building these things are actually saying, you know what, in order to monetize this for myself, I'm going to build some applications on top, and those applications are going to have token investment opportunities, or they're going to have equity investment opportunities. And that's great. I think it's just going to come down a little bit, down the line from now. And when you're evaluating, let's say, an equity opportunity in, I guess you would call that like layer three or something like that, right? You not only have to evaluate like the application that's being built and on its own merits, but you also have to ask yourself, am I making the right underlying network investment decision? Because if I invest in this application on this network, but then some other network becomes the dominant network, did I make the best investment there? And so it becomes like a lot trickier to reason about tokens and equity in layer two, rather than just saying, hey, maybe I'll just run five different kinds of hubs, watchers, or dispute resolvers on layer two, and then try to get exposure that way and try to sort of diversify and, make bets that maybe a few of these networks will become really big later.
Jake, I think you said something really interesting earlier, where you were talking about how some of these layer two solutions can go across chains. And so I think that also presents, another interesting opportunity for investors who are, looking to invest in things other than the base layer protocol is, I think this lowers the risk, where if your product is really compelling and, you built it on Ethereum for now, but as it turns out, one of these next gen like smart contract platforms ends up actually fulfilling the vision and becoming the dominant smart contract platform. Well, if you can transfer over the state and the code base of whatever the product is, whatever the dApp or smart contract is, onto this other platform, well, then you're not really exposed to the risk as either a founder or an investor of the underlying platform. And so I think that's another opportunity where, the risk return calculation needs to be re-examined from first principles rather than necessarily, looking at this the same way that it has been looked at in the past.
Yeah, so exactly. And thank you for bringing that up. And, one way to just characterize that is sort of products that have interoperability with their base layers, right? So these might be interoperability platforms like Polkadot or, in some sense, like what Cosmos is building. It might be what Chris Bernisky likes to call middleware protocols, right? So these might be like stablecoin protocols that live kind of in the middle of the stack. And the point here is precisely that, right? Like these kinds of interoperable
mechanisms live higher in the stack than the layer or than the base layers, right? And that's another reason why, you know, you can imagine a bet on sort of the middle of the stack being a little bit safer than bets on fat protocols, like all the way at the bottom of the stack, if that makes sense. Because, you know, if you have an interoperability platform that has 100 networks interoperating on it, but then one of those networks fails, that's not going to be, you know, as bad as if you were like all in on that one network that failed, right?
Absolutely.
You create diversification.
I think the diversification is really interesting here, but then if you contrast that with the fat protocol thesis, which, you know, I'll stand up and say, I think I'm one of the few people who, you know, is willing to still defend the fat protocol thesis. I think it's actually correct. I think that the vast majority of the value that is created through this blockchain ecosystem is going to be captured in some base layer protocols. And I don't know exactly how many, but my guess is it's going to be a power law type distribution. And the largest one will be a smart contract platform, just for security model reasons, right? If you have something built on top of this platform that's more valuable than the platform, well, now it can justify an attacker to go and attack the base layer platform in order to get value on that layer two solution or the, you know, whatever was built on top of the platform. And so I think the base layer protocols actually present a more concentrated, riskier bet that has a potentially much higher return than these middleware type solutions, which can skate across protocols if necessary. They can interoperate across protocols if necessary, but they don't have the same level of potential to have the huge mega outcomes that a base layer protocol does.
Yeah, that actually goes to that question I asked early on when I was asking you guys to compare this against things like just investing in the tokens directly, because I agree with you that I do think it seems like the ROI here might be less. However, what the sort of like the way in which it's not less is that because it will help the network grow, then perhaps the value of the token would grow or would ensure that the investment that you made in the token would succeed, something like that, or help ensure. We're actually running out of time, so I just want to ask you a few last quick questions. When VCs began investing in tokens, a lot of them had to change their LP agreements. Do you guys need to do that at all in order to make this work?
Not for us. We are a crypto native fund, so we launched with our LPA being amenable to us owning tokens.
And Jake, did you guys?
Yeah. So when we were kind of bringing up CoinFund, you know, we made sure that our agreement was sort of in balance with the kind of investments that we would make. And so in general, I think we're very, very flexible in how we can invest. You know, we can make equity investments, we can sign SAFs or safe notes or convertible notes, as well as invest in tokens. As of this year, we have some additions to our corporate structure that allow us to engage networks directly as well.
And so with both of you now getting into generalized mining as a part of your strategy, how does that affect the way that you hire or other sorts of administrative or technical or strategic decisions you guys make as a fund?
From our point of view, we have a full-time principal engineer named Jason on our staff who's kind of in charge of looking across these sorts of opportunities. Both me and my co-founder, Alex Bulkin, we are technologists and engineers, and so we participate in that process. And generally, I think that, you know, this creates kind of an onus on funds to be a little bit more technologically enabled. And so I think more technical hires are probably key to this. And then in addition to just, you know, participating in the opportunities, there's also a bunch of, you know, accounting considerations and tax considerations and working through sort of the reporting of what these activities that the fund has been engaged in are. And that creates, you know, additional sort of motivations for hires.
I would imagine actually maybe from a tax perspective, it's more advantageous because if you're, at least in the case where you're sort of like earning the tokens, then or not earning, but like, maybe it only applies if you're mining them and they're being minted at that moment. Because I was just thinking about how if you purchase them and then you later sell them, then there's two tax events. But at least in the case of mining, I think where they're being minted at that moment, there's only one tax event, which happens when you sell. So can you just talk a little bit more about the differences in taxes here?
Yeah. I think generalized mining actually introduces some more complexities on taxes because of UBTI issues, which, you know, some funds and LPs have some restrictions around.
UBTI?
UBTI is unrelated taxable business income. If you are a tax exempt investor, whether that's, some sort of foundation or trust or some other type of setup. And I am not a tax attorney. So, to all the listeners, please consult your tax attorney. But there are some restrictions around earning effectively operational income from an investment. And for tax exempt investors that, don't pay capital gains taxes, earning UBTI can actually pierce that and cause them to have to pay taxes. This is most relevant to the layperson through like investing in their IRA, where, you have some level of restriction on the amount of UBTI you're allowed to have in your IRA before you have to file like tons more tax paperwork. So I think generalized mining adds some more complexity there, but, at the end of the day, I think it's worth it. And, going back to my earlier point of, I think generalized mining is best executed by small professional organizations and not necessarily by lay people. That means that the resources to actually account for all of this in compliance with, all the relevant regulatory and tax law is actually much more plausible than, someone who's a hobbyist going and doing this on their own, where, it may not be really economically rational for them to do so once they take the accounting and tax prep work into account.
Interesting. Well, I guess we'll see how all this plays out. Thank you guys both so much for coming on the show to discuss. We could keep going. There's just so much material here, but we're running out of time. So where can people learn more about you and your companies?
For us, we have a website, coinfund.io. You can check out that, and has a description of our team and sort of broader investment thesis. On the generalized mining stuff, we actually just ran a very successful meetup over at DevCon in Prague, where Multicoin Capital also participated. And we'll be releasing the video of that shortly, and hopefully that gives some more material to this discussion.
Great. Tushar?
And you can find out more about Multicoin Capital on our website as well. It's multicoin.capital. And we have a good number of posts on there. And actually, there's one that Jake referred to earlier that I released a couple of weeks ago called The Evolving Role of Crypto Investors, which specifically covers some of the topics that we've discussed today on this podcast. And I think if you're still interested and want to dive deeper, we will be releasing videos from the Multicoin Summit where we had a panel called The Evolving Role of Crypto Investors, where Jake's partner, Alex, also participated. So there's a lot of interesting content there to dig deeper and learn more about this topic.
Great. I will link to all this in the show notes. Thanks, you guys, for coming on Unchained.
Thank you, Laura, for having us.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks so much for joining us today. To learn more about Jake and Tushar, check out the show notes inside your podcast player. New episodes of Unchained come out every Tuesday. If you haven't already, rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. If you like this episode, share it with your friends on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. And if you're not yet subscribed to my other podcast, Unconfirmed, I highly recommend you check it out and subscribe now. Unchained is produced by me, Laura Shin, with help from Raylene Gallipoli, Fractal Recording, Jenny Josephson, and Daniel Ness. Thanks for listening.